Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 118 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me are a few other airplane geeks. First, we have Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hi, Dan.
Hello, and good evening, or good whatever time of day it is for when you're listening. That wasn't as smooth as I had hoped, but hi.
Hi, Dan. Also with us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Well, good evening, and thanks for listening. And I'm not even going to try and top Dan. I mean, I think he did such an excellent job there.
Wasn't that wonderful?
Wow, you're so nice.
And also with us is David Vanderhoof. He blogs at What Just Flew By. Hi, David.
Good afternoon, evening, night, gentlemen, and hello to our listeners.
Our guest this episode is Mary Kirby. She's the runway girl. She blogs at flightglobal.com. Mary, glad to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's always terrific. Now, we understand you've been traveling a lot lately.
I have. I've been on the road a lot. I was in London recently for an airline social media conference, which was fascinating. And before that, I was in Long Beach for the Airline Passenger Experience Association annual conference and exhibition, which was co-located with Aircraft Interiors.
Wow.
And before that, a number of other places that I don't remember right now.
Okay. Well, good. We'll look forward to talking about some of those experiences.
The Aircraft Passenger Experience Conference? Is that what you said?
Yes, it's the Airline Passenger Experience Association. They were formerly known as the World Airline, WAEA.
Oh, okay. Oh, God.
The world's greatest airline, oh, God.
Oh, God. World Airline Entertainment Association. They used to be known as the WAEA, and they have moved on because they understand that they play a role in the larger passenger experience. And so now they're embracing all parts of that experience and welcoming new members as we speak. So it's exciting.
Cool.
All right. Well, why don't we get started with the week's news? Everybody ready?
Yep.
Check.
Our first story comes from the Vancouver Sun. Air Canada forges deal with United. Well, Canada has foreign ownership caps, like most places do, and it's limited Air Canada's ability to merge with other airlines. But as the article points out, Air Canada has been looking around, finding different ways to push, as this says, the foreign ownership limits by striking a series of joint ventures across the Atlantic and the U.S. Now, earlier this year, they put together a deal with Lufthansa, United, and Continental Airlines. That was the A++ initiative. And just recently, they've put together a similar deal with the new United. Dan, what does this really mean?
United Air Canada have actually been Star Alliance partners for a very long time. Almost since the beginning. It's been a while. And they're already co-chair, and as you mentioned, Max, already part of the A++ venture of the Atlantic. But just getting closer, and I mean, they already co-chair in a lot of transborder routes, but basically now they can get together and coordinate schedules and pricing together. So, I mean, that seems to make sense, but we'll probably, you know, work very well. The reason I also found this interesting is the other question is, for other Canadian airlines, specifically WestJet, what's going to happen with them for a partner? Because they do not have a partner at this point. Back in 2009, Southwest announced a deal with WestJet, and it kept getting delayed, and eventually partnership broke off, and it was rumored for a while that WestJet would partner with Delta. We haven't really heard anything there for a while. So I guess what I'm wondering here is, what's WestJet's next move? Because partnering up with other airlines, they announced a co-chair with Cathay a short while ago. So, and I think Porter eventually needs a partner. So, I mean, this is a very logical move for United, but I'm also wondering what it means for other carriers and even other American carriers on transborder routes. So, for example, Virgin America already facing tough competition from Air Canada and United when they started flying from LA and San Francisco to Toronto. So, does this really affect them? They're a small player in the market, but I'm interested in it, and hopefully we'll be asking them about it later this week.
Well, another interesting aspect of this deal, I think, is that Air Canada is effectively are trying to achieve the same things that are many of the same things that, that they would or they could if they entered into a joint venture or merged their airline with another. So they're trying to, I guess, maintain their own identity, but still get some of the benefits of a merger. Are there other airlines that are taking the same kind of approach? Are you aware of any?
Well, I mean, you can still have a merger and maintain the identity. I mean, just look at look at the big players in Europe. I mean, you have Lufthansa owning Swiss and Austrian, keeping those identities. Air France, KLM is a big one. British Airways and Iberia. And I mean, especially there in Europe, I mean, if Air France merged with KLM and then painted planes in an Air France livery, that would not go over well with customers. So
yeah, sure.
In this case, you definitely want to keep the brand identity. And in a lot of cases, countries like in the U.S., you have foreign ownership rules. So a foreign party can't have more than a 25% stake in an airline here. So this is the best way that airlines can get around it and try to get some of those benefits. Eventually, I mean, I'd like to see those foreign ownership rules relax, but really have no idea when that could happen.
Yeah, I don't know if we see any action to relax those foreign ownership rules. I'm not really aware of anything in the Congress or in the executive branch.
Well, it was something that was discussed, I believe, in the EU-US open skies agreement, but I don't think it really has gotten anywhere. There's always been a fear of foreign interests taking advantage of taking too much control of a U.S. carrier. And I believe, and this is someone something we need Evan Sparks for, I believe that's linked to back in the old days. Well, it's still there, but of the Silver Reserve Air Fleet program. But that's a whole other topic for another day.
Yeah, but that's what every country's afraid of, aren't they? I mean, that some other country's airline's going to come in and tell them what to do. But how'd they make it work in Europe? They were just about out of options, really, weren't they?
Yeah, I don't know enough about the European side. I could definitely see that side. So I think a decent compromise would be let's raise the 25% limit to a 49% limit so they can't still be a controlling stake.
Well, Dan, you mentioned open skies. Our next article is actually on that topic that comes from Bloomberg, which is U.S. and Japanese airlines win approval for alliance. And this notes that four U.S. and Japanese carriers have just won federal immunity from antitrust prosecution for their partnerships on routes between the U.S. And Asia. This is kind of interesting. I think this has been percolating for a while, and the DOT has found that the cooperation of the carriers in these alliances would improve competition, lower fares, and increase schedule options. That's what the DOT has said. This is the start of something significant. United and Continental and All Nippon Airways, ANA, made their request in December, and then we have American Airlines and Japan Airlines request, and the government kind of combined these and made one conclusion for them all. So I guess this is good news, right?
Yeah, it's definitely good news for the airlines, and I guess good news for American. I mean, just earlier, months ago when the whole thing about will JAL stay in one world. So it's definitely good. I think, and this I also found interesting because, I mean, we've been talking about antitrust immunity across the Atlantic for years, and this is relatively new for the Pacific. But the other issue that's very interesting is, and I'm quoting a Wall Street Journal article from December because I had to refresh memory on this. It says the bilateral accord following a decade of on-again, off-again talks is contingent upon Japan's two largest airlines, Japan Airlines and All Nippon, winning antitrust approval. So basically, Japan has made signing the agreement with the U.S. contingent on getting the immunity. So that would satisfy that condition. And another interesting part of the Open Skies Pact is U.S. carriers getting, albeit limited, access to Haneda.
To Haneda, right.
Yes. And that'll be with Delta service to the LA and Detroit, and they actually just got a approval from the DOT recently to delay their service by a month. Hawaiian to Honolulu and American from JFK.
So the effect of this is for the traveling public is what? Access to airports in Japan and in Asia, I guess.
That's part of it,
US
but
carriers.
I mean, a lot of the other benefits, I mean, airlines working together, they can sell things together, hopefully coordinating their schedules. Like, I mean, we'll see how it goes, but the other alliance news is a lot of JV news this week. American and British Airways and Iberia kicking things off and basically say, you know, we're going to essentially have a shuttle, granted it's across a couple different airports, from New York to basically with the departure to London every half hour for a certain period in the evening. And I mean, they can better coordinate schedules. So, for example, I don't remember. I think in the morning from JFK, there an American flight and a British Airways flight to London that leave within 5 minutes of each other, which seems sort of impractical. But we'll see. I mean, so you can just have the two airlines, you know, better coordinate their schedules and such. So we'll see how American thing out there. But yeah, I mean, overall, I mean, concern among some parties, will antitrust immunity be a negative for the consumer fare wise? But I mean, DOT, you know, thinks that there are adequate consumer benefits, and this is that these alliances are overall positive.
And is that really the only concern? Is in terms of pricing?
I'd say that's the biggest concern. Yeah, about it basically. And actually, there are a couple interesting guest posts on Cranky Flyer from a while. Actually, he may have wrote it, but there's some good posts on Cranky Flyer, either by Cranky or not by Cranky, about these alliances. And basically the concern for the Atlantic is you've had so many airlines competing across the Atlantic, and essentially by creating these joint ventures, you're reducing the number of competitors, which, you know, could, some might say that's a negative.
Okay. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah. So I'm going to shut up now and get back to drinking my tea. I should tweet that.
No, you shouldn't.
That's right. Stay focused.
Mary, you tweet that for Dan.
Okay.
Next article is from Aviation Week. Southwest wants into Washington National. So Southwest Airlines and a number of others are trying to acquire two slot exemptions. These are up for grabs at Reagan National Airport in Washington. And this is for service to medium hub or smaller airports within 1,250 miles. Now, Dan, I'm going to have to ask you to explain this because I think it's a little confusing. These slots were originally Republic Airways slots, I guess, Midwest Airlines slots that they acquired in 2004, and then Republic Airways acquires Midwest and thinks that now they have the slots, but the DOT is saying that the slot allocation does not cover that kind of a situation where one carrier acquires another. Have I got it right, Dan?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm going to say I think because the amount of paperwork and regulatory filings that have been generated over these two slots, yesterday I make sense of all the applications, and I think after an hour I'm like, wow, I'm just as confused as I was an hour ago. But yeah, basically these slots, and it's like a special kind of slot that was created a few years ago under the Clinton administration, and it's just a mess. Basically, they cannot be transferred. It's sort of a mess, really, because Republic saying, well, yes, we acquired Midwest, and Midwest is not going to be flying its own planes anymore, but we, as Republic, we are keeping the Midwest brand separate from everything else. And then JetBlue was complaining about, well, we want these slots and five other slot slides. There's slot slides. It was basically you have slots, but you can slide them to different times of the day, which I don't even want to get into because we could have a whole podcast about slots. So it was interesting. JetBlue did not apply. And so I asked them about that. And they said that they're acquiring one slot pair limited to specific cities defined by the government and not by the free market or by JetBlue itself made such an application economically infeasible. Other airlines have given it a shot, and we'll see how it pans out. Right now, Vertran, I believe, is applying for Sarasota or Fort Myers service. U.S. Air applying for Pensacola service, which they've been trying for a while. Public wants to keep the slot for Kansas City. Southwest wants it to go to Kansas City. And Southwest is interesting because it's not mentioned in the filing, as far as I know. I need to dig a little bit deeper. But I have to wonder, would Southwest really operate one flight a day to and from Washington National? That really makes that'd be very weird for them, because I think their smallest city has 8 departures. I think that's still LaGuardia. I'm not sure, but they don't like stations with like one departure. So would Southwest have applied for this slot if they were not merging with AirTran? I really have no idea. That's complete speculation on my part.
Yeah. I don't know, Mary. I don't know. My head's about to explode. Did you get all that?
Yeah, I have, I think. I've been tweeting about it, actually. Dan is talking about slots right now, which is always fascinating, Dan.
But yeah, so we have the two slot proceedings for the proceedings for these two slots, and then later, I have no idea when, Republic's already applied for it because the DOT let them, the applications for the slot slides, possibly. So I'm just going to stop talking about this now, because we'll see what happens to the slot slides.
Well, thanks, Dan. I mean, I was going to say all that, and then you just took it right away from me.
I took the words out of your mouth.
Yeah,
huh?
I took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, he does that kind of stuff, Henry.
Yeah, that's incredible.
I'm a dork. Yeah.
That's why we love
you.
You want to, you can never be a dork in my eyes ever, because I went to see, what's that, the Social Network film last night?
Oh, yes.
Mark
right.
Zuckerberg. Yeah. You couldn't possibly hold a candle to that guy. That guy's a dork.
I'm hurt. But just
smart dork.
Sorry, just
dork.
And rich.
And rich. Yeah.
Just add, finish this color. The department instructed Republic to submit an application to retain its five slot slides within 60 days of the November 25th date of the letter. They did that. And it says another footnote, the department will conduct a separate proceeding with regard to Republic's five slot slide exemptions at DCA. So
okay.
I am done now. But if you want more, I am hopefully be blogging about this.
Well, I'm glad Virgin Galactic doesn't have slots to worry about, because then we'd have to talk about that some too.
Not yet.
But not yet. That's right. That's right. Well, we see in Space Flight Now that Virgin Galactic has actually conducted the first piloted free flight of its suborbital spaceship. That's what they now call the VSS Enterprise. And what they've done is they've released rocket plane, I guess you'd call it, from the White Knight 2 from an altitude of 45,000 feet. And the thing has successfully glided down and touched down at the Mojave Air and Spaceport after just 11 minutes after being released. But this is the first test of that that craft's gliding characteristics. This article says that the craft was not equipped with a rocket motor that will come in later testing, but this was just the glide testing portion of this program. So this is pretty exciting. This looks like it's moving forward. I think this might be the ultimate flying experience for enthusiasts. Not cheap, but looks like it's getting closer to being a reality.
Two things. A, how do we get on the press list for the first flight? And yeah, I forgot my other thing.
Get in a very, very, very long line.
I wonder how long that line is. That's actually an interesting thing. I mean, $200,000 a flight, and this is not orbital. This is suborbital. You get into space, but you're...
Yeah, what did we figure? 5 minutes, I think they said, the actual space flight part is?
Right, it's relatively short. You do get to experience weightlessness. Yeah, and like I say, $200,000 sounds like a lot, but I bet there are quite a few people who are in that line to spend that kind of money for an adventure like this.
Yeah, you know, and that's, I bet you're probably right. I think what I'd be concerned about, if it were me, is how do they get the cost down to the point that they increase the market share, that this doesn't become a short-term Concorde?
Mm-hmm. You would expect that they'd be able to do that. I don't know if there are any competitors in the wings, really, at this point, though.
Oh, I don't think there are.
I don't know, Mary, have you checked out the interior accommodations yet of this thing? What's the... What are the seats like? Do you have any idea?
I don't, actually. To be honest with you, I don't. I've seen some interesting blogs about what they could be like. And, you know, didn't somebody write that there was an old 80s band that's going to be playing in the first flight? I'm trying to think what it was.
Oh.
Yeah.
Great.
They have some
it's
unique bands for Inside Entertainment. But, I guess it's time to start paying attention to them.
Hey, Max.
Yeah,
USA
David.
Today is reporting that 370 customers already have put down their deposits totaling 50 million down payments.
Interesting. That's an interesting number. Wow.
Mary, two questions for you. What will be the connectivity solution chosen by Virgin Galactic?
Yeah.
And will they have the stand-up seats?
Okay, so refresh my memory. When is first flight scheduled for?
I don't think anyone said that yet.
Okay, so the answer depends on when first flight is scheduled. If it's scheduled for before 2014, Then it would be a Ku band satellite based connectivity system. If it's after 2014, it will be more than likely a Ka band satellite based connectivity system.
And what's the big difference?
Internet. The big difference is speed. Number one, there is Inmarsat is the L band leader right now, and they recently announced that they have commissioned Boeing to build three Ka band satellites that will provide ultra high speed in flight connectivity on a near global scale.
Really?
And at a price point that people can afford. So, but that's 2014 and beyond, and that would be more than likely what you'd have as a passenger on your way to the moon.
Okay, but that still supports my argument that goes back to other in flight connectivity. Really, folks, you're paying that much money to go into orbit and you're going to be looking at your laptop?
That's a very
good point. Wow.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. You know, but, you know, down the road, ultimately, there will come a point where someone says, really, I need to be connected and I need to be able to tweet about this moment. Yeah. And I tweet about it right now. And you're going to need connectivity to do that. So.
Okay, I'll accept that, Mary. But the first couple of guys, I hope they're looking out the window.
Yeah. Oh, I do too.
So, Mary, well, I guess since you said KA for 2014, because I don't remember, when does JetBlue really start up their in-flight Wi-Fi? Is it not until then?
Okay, so now that's a very good question. They're going to in the United States, there is already Ka band satellite capacity in the United States. So there's a global solution coming in 2014 that would be more than likely necessary for your moon travels. But there right now is a Ka band capacity over the United States and over Europe. And that is what JetBlue is doing. They're tapping into that through a partnership with Viasat. They're hoping to seal the deal by the end of the year. And it's a great solution, at least on the face of it, for a domestic U.S. or, you know, a mainland Europe solution. Ka band is available technically in the not too distant future. I think JetBlue is saying 2012, so, you know, in a couple years.
Hmm. Yeah, cool.
But if you wanted to do that on it, you couldn't do that for transatlantic service right now. You don't have Ka band capacity covering the transatlantic routes. So right now, if you want to do transatlantic and Trans-Pacific, you need to use a Ku band solution, the likes of which is being brought to market by Row 44 and Panasonic Avionics, and or you need to go with L band Inmarsat, which is a lower bandwidth connectivity.
How is the Panasonic solution coming along? I mean, that isn't that been sort of a relative newcomer?
Yeah, well, you know, Panasonic vowed to fill the void left by connection by Boeing. That was, you know, connection ended service at the end of 2006. So the Panasonic solution is a long time coming. It is up and running and being tested quite successfully right now on a Boeing business jet. So they've kind of been going great guns with the BBJ. But their immediate need is to reignite Lufthansa's Flynet service that is this former connection service that Lufthansa flew. On a very large portion of its aircraft. And Lufthansa has kept those big antennas that Boeing Connection had, and they've asked Panasonic to essentially make this all go again. And that is what they're doing right now. I think they've got it installed on, they may have it now on as many as 10 aircraft right now. They're flight testing it right now. Mm-hmm. And it looks like they're going to have a good chance of launching this in November. They'd like to do it. It's my understanding that they'd like to get it out there before Christmas so that they can kind of capitalize on all the Christmas promotions that they can do with the service. So hopefully in the next few weeks, we're going to hear some news from Lufthansa.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We're jumping ahead a little bit, but that's fine. That's fascinating stuff. Let's do one more news story. This is a military story from Ynet News.
Is this about the tanker?
No, it's not about the tanker, but it's about F-35s. And David's going to be able to help us on this one. Israel is signing up now to purchase, 20 F-35 fighters. David, this the headline says, I don't know if that says F-35I or L or 1.
It says F-35I.
And what Israel. Is an F-35? Okay, it's an Israeli-specific variant.
We have now a fourth version of the F-35, and it hasn't even gone into full production yet. The A is the standard land-based fighter. The B is the STOVL, or short takeoff vertical landing.
Right.
And C is the carrier-based. The I will be based on the A. The biggest controversy between Israel buying the F-35 or not was Israel has their own electronics packages in all of their aircraft. As a matter of fact, the mast-mounted head sight for the F-35 is actually designed by an Israeli company. But they wanted their own avionics, and they wanted their own electronic protection. So, and the Air Force and the Navy said, no, you're going to get them the way we wanted them. So we've had about 2 years of them going back and forth, Israel saying, we want to be able to put in what we want in them. And otherwise, we're not going to buy them. Well, the result is now they will get the F-35. It will be the land-based version, and they will have the ability to incorporate their own electronics, thus creating the F-35I. Hmm. So it'll be a completely different internal electronics right. than it would be for any of the other foreign nations getting the F-35, like Canada or Turkey or Australia. It'll be a completely different beast altogether.
Is this the first buy by a country that's not a partner in the program?
It is. It is the very first buy by a non-partner. The partners currently are the United States, the UK, Canada, Netherlands, Denmark, Turkey. I'm missing one. Netherlands, Denmark, Turkey.
Australia?
Australia. But there's one more European country. Shoot.
That's okay.
I'm going to do a Dan and look it up.
That's all right. Well, while you're doing that.
I'm sorry that I look things up. Is that a problem? Like, honestly.
No. You're a better person than me because you actually, like, do it without thinking.
Oh, no. I was on regulations.gov the entire slot time and opening up PDFs, so don't worry.
You mean that it wasn't just flowing out of your head?
Well, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. By the way, Mary, thank you for the very ambiguous tweet there. That's very special.
It's my specialty, Dan.
Yeah, well, I used to write
a column called Mary Mary Quite Contrary, so.
You did? Is that for real?
That's awesome.
Yeah? For real, in college, yeah.
Oh, wow.
College humor column, actually.
Yeah?
So, yeah.
That's cute.
Thanks.
If we Google that, will we be able to find it?
I doubt it, because that was back in the day before Google and before we put those things online. I'm actually older than I look, guys.
Oh, we could find these, I bet. Listen, if Bill Maher can find all those videos of that crazy lady, what is it, Vermont? No. Delaware? It's running for Senate?
Oh,
God.
Yeah, I mean, we can find this stuff. We just have to go looking.
Speaking of fighting stuff.
Yes, David.
Thanks for stalling, guys.
Yeah, we tried.
The original ones are United Kingdom, Italy, Netherlands, Canada, Turkey, Australia, Norway, and Denmark.
Okay. Now, are there...
There are other ones. And God help me, I'm looking at this at Wikipedia. Israel, who've now created the I, also Singapore is looking to participate in the program.
Oh. Well, the more the merrier, right? At least in terms of unit costs, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Well, unless you're like Israel and want to completely redesign the whole interior for your own electronics. Mm.
Does anyone else do that, or is that pretty much a unique situation to Israel?
I do it, actually.
Oh, you do too, Dan?
Mm. Dan, I have to make sure that my fighter jets have dice.
Okay.
His airliners do the same thing.
I bet. Again, Mary Kirby is with us, the runway girl from FlightGlobal.com.
See, I thought she was a runaway girl at first. Has anyone ever said that to you before that they got that little screwed up?
Many people, actually. And in fact, a former colleague who will remain nameless used to call me the tramping runaway. So,
wow.
I'm not sure.
I have to point out that.
Like that at Flight Global.
There goes our G rating.
Yeah. I would say that I am not that former colleague. So.
Okay, it's not Dan.
No, but the runaway girl, actually, it's become more and more appropriate because I go to these air shows and conferences, and I literally run the entire time. And I'm so tempted. I kind of daydream about bringing tennis shoes with me and putting the high heels away and just slap on the tennis shoes, and because I need it. My feet are double their normal size at the end of these shows. So
that's an attractive image.
Runaway girl.
Well, tell us about your recent trip to London and the social media session there.
Yeah, no, it was really amazing. These airlines all over the world are harnessing kind of the power of social media, and the equation has really gone beyond return on investment. That used to be the big question. Well, how is there a return on investment, and can we make money using social media? Remember, that was the big question, Rob, maybe about a year ago. You know, what's the point?
Sure.
Why are we doing this? Well, the answer is that it is absolutely necessary. You're out of your mind if you're an airline today not using this marketing tool. Carriers like Malaysian, like Air Baltic, and carriers here on the mainland, U.S., that JetBlue, even United, that are really exploiting this for financial gain. It's now part of the business. And so this conference, it was co-hosted by Airline Business, which is part of the Flight Global suite of publications, and Simplifying, you know, our friend Shashank.
Oh, yes.
And he gave out awards also, the first annual Simplifying Social Media Awards for Airlines. And it was just amazing. It was so edifying to see the progress in just such a short period of time of how airlines are really moving forward, turning this into a revenue generator, turning it into a way to connect with passengers on a whole new level, and also into using it for crisis management. We saw a tremendous presentation by Eurocontrol. You'll remember during the ash cloud how Eurocontrol really stepped up and kept people informed and abreast of everything that was going on.
Right.
With that ash cloud, the woman who was behind that really gave an amazing presentation about how her job changed overnight using Twitter and Facebook. And so to me, I just sat there, and it was a total education. I chaired the conference, but I sat there every time I sat down after introducing these folks. It was a complete education. And I'm convinced now more than ever that any company out there that's not using social media is really shortchanging themselves.
Mary, I'm curious, when you talked when you spoke about the revenue generation, elaborate on that a little for me. Well, how are they generating revenue?
So some of these carriers are out there doing, you know, kind of Twitter only promotions. We've seen it here in the U.S. with JetBlue, like All You Can Jet. We've seen United do it with their Twares program, and many of the carriers here in the U.S. and in Europe are doing that. But some airlines are going a step beyond that, and really getting very, very creative and going to the point where they're, you know, convincing passengers and customers to come along the ride with them. So, for example, Malaysian launched this special program where they essentially got people so excited about the product that when they finally did this fare sale, you know, they sold out something like 585,000. I mean, it was just absolutely unbelievable what they ended up making, just because they were generating so much excitement on social media in advance of the fare sale. And everybody came along for the ride.
And it would be interesting to see what the ages of the people were that bought those tickets. I wonder if they were younger folks or if folks past the age of 40, let's say.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, that's the interesting thing. I mean, obviously, Twitter is big. It's big with obviously the likes of us, right, and journalists and bloggers, sure, and anybody in media right now, you know, is on Twitter and kind of disseminating the information. But Facebook, I mean, the demographic for Facebook is, you know, you got your mothers and your grandmothers.
Yeah, that's pretty broad.
Facebook, and they're using it, and so you can kind of hit really all demographics by harnessing those two. They also mentioned how it's not just Facebook and Twitter. Depending upon what area of the world you're in, Friend Feed is popular in some parts of the world, and Bing is popular. So there's depending upon what region you're in, but But yes, yeah, some really interesting things. And Lufthansa was one of the carriers that won an award for its MySky status solution. Have you guys seen anything on that? It's really MySky status from Lufthansa.
No.
I mean, that allows you to let, you know, all of your, you know, social networks know, you know, where you're at and where you're flying. And what it does is, you know, ultimately when Lufthansa gets that in-flight connectivity that we were talking about earlier, it just opens up a whole new realm for Lufthansa. If you can imagine, you get on that aircraft and you combine it with your social media prowess, and just the sky's the limit in what you can do and how you can connect with your passenger and how you can, you know, have real time connectivity and real time connections and real time customer service in flight.
Now, you know, it's one thing to, you know, make a corporate decision that you're going to start to use these kinds of approaches, but it's another thing to use them well, you know, to use them effectively. What are you seeing in that regard? Are airlines using these things well, or are a lot of them just sort of grabbing at them and not being very effective?
Well, some of them, you know, are being rather creative, and you know, like I mentioned, Malaysian won an award. Air Baltic has been doing kind of fascinating things. Carriers here in the United States are you know, breaking the bounds of social media, and they're really just, you know, sometimes it's a team of people, and sometimes it's just one person who's just been tasked with this. Like, you're in marketing, and go figure this out. And Some of the people are getting very, very creative with what they can do and how they can do it. And, you know, we, you know, as an industry really need to talk about this a lot more and get the word out about the carriers that are doing kind of the amazing things. We've seen it, you know, and of course, and Dan, of course, you know, could say for Southwest, I mean, they've just been a real leader here in the United States.
Right.
Paula Berg from Southwest, who, of course, instigated that whole the whole social media platform for Southwest, was at the conference, and she gave some just a tremendous presentation and really insightful comments about how they did it. And
she was an early guest on the show.
Oh yeah, was she?
Yeah.
Oh, she's wonderful. She's wonderful.
Oh, she's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for anybody that needs to know, Paula is she's not attached.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she is not attached. At least the last I talked to her, she's
Now, how do you know
attached.
That, and why do you know that?
Because I'm a older fellow who notices this kind of stuff.
So
let's just leave it at that, Max.
Okay. Well,
for your free weekend call, yeah. 01, yeah. We'll set you up with Paula Berg.
Going to be so grateful that we went to this area. But no, she speaking of engaging, this is an engaging person, but she engaging is the key behind Southwest's strategy. I mean, bringing in the customer and really getting them excited about the product, and then ultimately, you know, that flows over. I mean, it was so interesting how Southwest managed it. And you know, there's been some hiccups along the way. I actually asked Paula about, you know, the situation with that director, what's his name? Remember the guy who got upset about having
Kevin Smith.
Kevin Smith, right? Yeah. And she just, you know, she actually felt that Southwest did a relatively good job in handling that situation. And there's only so much you can do. I mean, you're always going to have problems, and that was one of them. But you just move along and you move forward. And as you know, you know, today's big social media story is forgotten tomorrow. I mean, who's still talking about that JetBlue guy who was sliding down the slides, you know what I mean,
right.
a month
yeah.
or two ago?
That's
it's forgotten, and we're on to the next big story, really, aren't we? So,
okay, but Mary, here's the real question. Who's doing it really badly?
Who's doing it badly? Oh, you can't put me in that position.
Yeah, put her on the spot.
Okay,
yeah,
well,
who is
challenged with the prospect of dealing with social media?
There's definitely some carriers here and abroad that aren't doing it as well as they should. But I have to say that, you know, generally we're seeing most airlines at least acknowledge that they need to do something about it, right? So some are faster on the uptake than others. You know, I'm impressed, quite frankly, with Delta's recent strides in social media and kind of how they're really reaching out. Yeah, do you agree, Dan, that it's interesting how they're really reaching out?
in a couple of ways. Not just, I mean, personally, I found that Delta on the PR side has really embraced bloggers lately. They've really made an effort to come reach out. For example, Cranky Flyer actually did a really good. He was able to visit with them and tour their operation. Actually, someone who we might should have on the show at some point, David Parker Brown on AirlineReporter.com, also got a chance to visit Delta. So really cool with bloggers lately, but also Delta Assist on Twitter, and they've expanded the hours.
Yeah,
and I think they're according to the Twitter page now, they have Monday to Friday 7 to midnight and Saturday to Sunday 8 to 10, and they have a few people, you know, experienced Delta employees manning the Twitter account, and it's really awesome. So I think it's really cool. I mean, and actually Delta people, I think it gets overlooked sometimes because Southwest definitely dominated blog, but Delta's had a great blog for a long time too. And I think other airlines are starting to sort of do a Delta, not necessarily follow, but do something. Frontier actually has a customer service Twitter account now.
Oh, that's interesting.
That they just started out. Called Frontier Care. And I don't know exactly how many people are on it or what the hours are. I'm actually hoping to talk to them more about it. But I think more airlines are starting to see this as a customer service tool, because the awkward thing about social media is, I mean, Twitter and Facebook could be used for sales and PR and customer support. So that's three completely different departments. So, if you have like a PR person manning your Twitter account, you could start tweeting about asking them for customer service. But the PR person, you know, the best they might be able to do is, you know, send you to the right place. They could definitely do that. But it's just so many different. You can use these mediums for so many different uses. I think it's very interesting to see have an airline like Delta and Frontier having like one Twitter. Like Delta has regular at Delta, they have Delta Newsroom, and they have Delta Assist. So like splitting it up a bit.
I'm kind of on the fence about whether that makes sense or not. But I do take your point with respect to the importance of having this kind of interdepartmental cooperation. And SAS, I believe it was, won the award, the Simplifying Award for their work in doing that and reacting to the ash cloud from an interdepartmental way. And they literally were pulling, you know, people that were educated about and would be able to help customers from all the different departments. And that's what's so fascinating. The carriers that get that, that understand that it's not just in marketing, it's not just in public relations, communications. It's got to be, you know, part of your overall strategy to connect with the consumer. Yeah, those are the carriers that get it, and those are the ones that are really succeeding at social media. I mean, to answer David's question, yeah, there are carriers out there that could do it better. I mean, you know, I probably bang on the door a little bit too much with respect to United Airlines, because I'm not a fan of their in-flight service. I have a problem overall with the customer service experiences that I've had with United. But I'd love to see United go beyond the fare sales and really engage customers a little bit more through social media. And I'm sure they're trying in various ways, but you know, I'd love to see them do a little bit more.
Barry, will they get better now? That is Continental any better?
Yeah, I think Continental. But fair enough. I mean, they're not great, but I've had a little bit more of a response from Continental than I have from United. I'm very hopeful that not just from a social media standpoint, really, you know, that they all pick up their game collectively across the board, including in the passenger experience, which is what I'm so focused on. Obviously, Continental right now is rolling out live television across the domestic portion of its fleet. So you've got this big portion of the now United fleet that's going to have live television. What does that mean for the rest of United domestic? Are they going to offer live television? Are they going to have a consistent product? You know, what are they going to do? Are they going to offer in-flight connectivity? They really need to make a decision. Now, you guys mentioned earlier JetBlue going with KA. Well, the hope is that other JetBlue owns live TV. The hope is that they will score other customers for this KA band connectivity that they're doing with Viasat and live TV. So that ultimately, I wouldn't be totally surprised if, say, for example, United were to announce KA band connectivity also for the United fleet, possibly down the road. So, but whether or not they'll offer live television is another question entirely. But
you know, one of the things lot of people are concerned about is now that, you know, people are saying, well, will United do well because of the merger. And I think a lot of people that have been devoted Continental flyers are worried that the Continental United experience is going to get worse. Because I agree with you, Mary. I mean, since we started here, I have never been a United fan. I mean, they're our hometown airline here in Chicago, but I will bite off my left arm not to have to fly on United.
Oh, well, that's pretty serious.
Yeah, that's pretty serious.
I'm gonna say a couple of things, just because a bunch of things. But Twitter, wildly enough, Mary, it's been the exact opposite for me. I've had more luck engaging United than Continental, interestingly enough.
Yeah, but on what kinds of topics, then? Pretend I'm a customer.
Actually, Brandon, I've never flown Continental, so I've never dealt with them on a customer basis. I've dealt with United on a customer basis on Twitter, and I've had a lot of luck. And that's why I think what could happen. I don't really know how United does it. That's why I think it's good like someone like a Delta has multiple people handling this Twitter account. Because, I mean, if you have one Twitter person with the sheer number of people on there, you can get overwhelmed very quickly, I think.
Yeah.
A couple of things about United. I mean, not just connectivity. I mean, Continental, which it made sense for the New York Sky team, having a two-class international configuration. United has three-class. What's going to happen there? And, I mean, you've had both carriers, right? I'm not sure if they're still doing it. I think they are, but I'm not positive exactly what the status of the installations are. But as recently upgrading their cabins,
right,
with especially the premium products, who knows how that'll shake out. And then United has Economy Plus. So that opens up a whole can of worms. But connectivity, I'm interested in because I mean, Central United both with GoGo, right? Yes.
They've got about 15 aircraft with GoGo. They've never, you know, as yet, they have not committed to kind of any kind of wide deployment of GoGo. And I think they're just really waiting, taking a wait and see approach, really, at this point.
Because I'm also interested in Frontier because, you know, with GoGo on the E-Jets and live TV on the Airbus.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, they're bringing those C-Series on, in 2015. And I think they see until then, like, this great experiment, really, between, you know, what will ultimately be, you know, what passengers are going to use and go to. And quite frankly, I think passengers would love to have both. And that's why I think United is in a really unique position where they could offer both. Because they, you know, they're bringing, you know, live TV is going on this large portion of their fleet now. And they could reach an agreement, presumably with live TV, to do KA band connectivity. And then you'd have a real killer in-flight experience. You might not be able to move your legs, but you would be connected and watching live television, which it would really boost, you know, United's profile a lot. And you know, at this point, that's important. The passenger experience is becoming more and more important. It really is, especially with social media and in-flight connectivity now. When people are able to tweet real life, you know, experiences,
it's
more important what you do in flight.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mary, let's talk for a second about.
When I was flying Virgin America the first time, I was watching CNBC and working on my laptop at the same time while trying to eat. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
Don't think my seatmate liked it, but it was, for me, it was awesome.
It's all about duplicating in the air what you can have in your living room, right? And being able to do that is really, that's where it's at.
I'm sure United's marketing department has a whole huge task ahead of them, figuring out what customers the other airline really value. And I'm sure
they should just listen to Airplane Geeks and they would know.
Yeah.
This is true. We should start charging that.
Connectivity, bring both.
Mary, let's talk about that in the context of business aviation. We've got the NBAA convention coming up, the National Business Aviation Association. And I guess Aircel is looking at starting some activity in this area.
Yeah, it's actually rather fantastic. Aircel has launched a social media crusade in advance of NBAA. And essentially what they want to do is convince the business aviation community to get on Twitter. They see the value in it. They actually consider it an invaluable tool. And they're really trying to get the word out in advance of and during NBAA to the rest of the business aviation community. And they've put together a great a pamphlet for newcomers, rather, to Twitter. And it walks you through everything that you need to do. So you can find that actually on my website at flightglobal.com/runwaygirl. And you'll be able to see just what Aircel is proposing and also why they're proposing it. They really see tremendous value in it, and they'd love to be able to get all these flight departments on Twitter and to be talking and coordinating and everybody getting their act together collectively. So
I'm not sure if I buy it. You know, I write about that a lot. So, I mean, I should be the strongest proponent of social media for business aviation. I'm sure, Mary, you and I can probably raise this issue down in Atlanta. But I said this when you posted that on your blog, I'm just concerned that business aviation folks, you know, don't see a monetary return in it like an airline does.
Right.
And unless they're kind of newsy, geeky people that want to know what certain blogs are doing or certain personalities have to say, I'm not sure they're going to find the value in tweeting. I'm just not convinced that, I know Tom Myers, and I think it was a heck of an idea that he had. It's a great idea because somebody's got to push the envelope. But that's what I'm really looking forward to. I hope someone brings this up down there at Atlanta because I'd like to hear what the people that operate the flight departments have to say about that.
Right. Well, obviously, Twitter and social media in general is now a given for the B2C world, right? I mean, it used to be that was a big question mark, and now there's been a resounding answer to that. If you're B2C, you need to be involved in social media. End of story. No question. B2B, it remains a question, and for a lot of people. But I admire the likes of Aircel for, as you say, pushing the envelope, because I think that, and we discovered this at the social media conference in London, that until you're out there and really using it, you know, the solutions kind of come to you as you use it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You innovate, right, absolutely. So, I mean, you and I and all of us are on Twitter. We're doing stuff now that we probably were not doing 6 months ago or a year ago. Is that fair to say? Using it in different ways?
I think so. I think that, you know, you grow it over time.
You grow it and finding value. And I personally, as a journalist, am finding value in it in ways that I never dreamed, right? So I think that that's the same concept that they're trying to employ. Like, listen, just get on it and then we'll figure out how, you know, and this is, and I'd like to say this is an original thought, but it isn't. Shawshank says this also. He said, just do it. Then worry about whether or not you're doing it right and whether what you need to, you know what I mean? That will come to you, but just start doing it, because to ignore it and to not do anything is not the answer. It just isn't. Not in today's day and age, you know?
No, I agree with you.
So just do it and you'll figure it out, you know?
We're going to have to see what happens, because last year at the conference when Binet and I were up there with Ryan Keough from Qatar Aviation and Patrick Dunn from NBAA, the conversations were very, very basic. And people still were trying to say, so what is this again?
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see how the conversation has changed in 1 year's time. But I think we have to make sure we raise this issue of Tom's paper.
Oh, absolutely. That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. Generate some good-
Mary, just a quick Aircel question. Is there really any clarity yet, just to bring it back to the airline side, what exact take rates are on average?
There isn't. And actually, I moderated a panel at this airline passenger experience conference in Long Beach about broadband connectivity and how to make money off of it. So I asked that question of Aircel, of Row 44, and they still will not give, you know, a clear cut answer to that question. You know, they say that obviously on certain routes that it's very popular and they're getting great take rates, and then on others it's not as much. But
that's really helpful. Very clear. Thanks.
Yeah, isn't it? Right. It's not. But in terms of hard and fast numbers, it's kind of hard to come by, actually, Dan. But
yeah, that's why I figured. I was just wondering, because if they would know, it would be you.
Thank you. I'm keeping an eye on it, hoping to the one day, you know, to have that answer.
And what's going on with Row 44? They have any customers really at this point, or are they kind of just banking on Southwest and Norwegian and Mango, I believe?
Okay, so those are the three carriers, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, with Southwest, you know, as a customer, they're a formidable competitor now. I mean, that's the reality. but they, you know, it costs a lot to use KU band capacity for just, you know, a few flights. So, you know, to get those transponders working over South Africa and over Europe for two carriers does, you know, how much is that going to cost ultimately? How much does that make sense? They need to start showing some other customers. I'd imagine that they are, you know, working on that right now. They've got some interesting, you know, backing, and they've got, at this juncture, it appears the finances to at least support the installs on Southwest, at least the next batch. So, yeah, they're definitely someone to keep an eye on. But yeah, it would be nice to see another customer from Row 44. Keep in mind, they're competing with Panasonic. So you have Panasonic, which is the number one in-flight entertainment manufacturer in the entire world, right? With 60% of the IFE market. So that's a real behemoth to be going up against with a standalone IFE connectivity solution. So, you know, you've got Panasonic that's saying to all of its IFE customers, you really need to go with this high-speed internet solution, and a lot of them are buying it. So you've got Cathay, you've got Lufthansa, you know, you've got Turkish Airlines, all these carriers that are, you know, bringing Panasonic connectivity together with the Panasonic IFE.
One more Row 44 question for you. When you say financing the deliveries, I guess what's the model there? Like, how much is South, like, are they paying to get it installed on Southwest airplanes? Am I reading that right, or what?
Yeah.
Like, who's paying?
Yeah. Okay, so there's obviously great speculation about what exactly the deal with Southwest entails, and good luck trying to get the details on that. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, it appears that there is some financing of installs going on. I mean, I find it hard to believe that Southwest would be footing the entire bill. It just, for a brand new product, that just wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. Southwest, you know, is taking a certain gamble, you know, with Row 44. Row 44 is a startup company. So, yeah, it's more than likely that Row 44 is financing, if not all, a good portion of the installations. So,
okay, that's great, Mary. Are there any other major things going on that we haven't touched on that you want to bring up?
The only thing I would say, finally, because we haven't mentioned it, is this Koito situation. I know we had talked about it months ago.
Right, this was the issue with the seats.
It's really blown up. This Japanese firm, you know, that made these seats and falsified test data on the seats, on 150,000 seats in the world fleet. Now EASA and FAA have issued proposed airworthiness directives, covering this issue. And now we have Thai Airways among the carriers suing Koito for a very significant amount of money, $550 million,
wow. Yeah.
Because of the delay to delivery. So, yeah, it's interesting times in the world of aircraft interiors on top of everything else that's going on. And if you're a carrier like, Singapore Airlines, EVA, Continental Airlines, now United, that is, you know, really impacted by this Koito situation, it's going to be very interesting to see how this all plays out, whether or not the lawsuits are going to fly. It looks like they are.
Mm.
And ultimately, who's going to be held accountable? Will it be Koito? Will they go bankrupt? Will it be the JCAB in Japan? And how hardcore is the FAA and European regulators going to go on this? So it's a big story in the world of interiors. So
yeah, and it sounds like there's a lot of money involved here. So people are going to look for remedies.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. But yeah, that's pretty much it. That's what's going on.
All right, great. We've been talking with Mary Kirby, the runway
wait,
girl.
Wait. Sorry, one last thing.
Yes, Dan.
Okay. Sorry, Mary, but I think we about this recently, but what do you think about the Southwest AirTran merger and what it means for AirCell and Row 44?
Honestly, I think that Southwest has made clear, and in everything that I've read from Southwest recently, including in their in-flight magazine, that they're committed to high-speed internet, right? They've gone in that direction. So it appears that they are reviewing AirTran's commitments right now to live TV and also to AirCell. So it's possible that down the road they might ultimately want a consistent product. You know, that would make sense. In the near term, though, Dan, I really don't see the big problem, you know, in offering two separate in-flight connectivity solutions. I think people can figure it out in the near term, but long term, they're going to want to have brand consistency, and it would make sense for them to, from just sheer size, to go with Row 44. I mean, that makes sense to me. And nothing against Aircel, because Aircel does a tremendous job, but that's not to say that Aircel isn't probably lobbying very hard to convince Southwest to just drop the whole Row 44 thing and just go Aircel across the board. But they've done that in the past, and they haven't been able to convince Southwest, because Southwest likes to have control over their connectivity, and Aircel keeps control. And that's the big difference in the Aircel model versus the Row 44 model. So,
cool. Thank you.
Great.
No firm answer, really. But, yeah. I mean, I guess if I was to bet, I would say they'll probably stick with Row 44. Yeah.
Did you say live TV at some point? Or
yes, yeah, so live TV provides the XM mode.
they do the XM? I did not know that.
Yeah, right. Live TV provides the XM satellite radio for AirTran. So, yeah. It's interesting, right? So you got kind of all kind of number of players now, because Live TV is a subsidiary of JetBlue, and now Row 44 and Aircel, and talk about a lot of people wanting to come to the table with Southwest.
Okay, we've been talking with Mary Kirby. You can find her on flightglobal.com/runwaygirl, and on Twitter at runwaygirl. Anywhere else, Mary, or is that where people need to go to find?
That's the main places. People can also come to Facebook or Friend Feed, but those are the main spots. I've also got a YouTube channel that I keep pretty active. Right. So Runway Girl Mary Kirby. And but yeah, all else fails, find me on the blog or Google me.
Fantastic.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Always great to have you. Thanks again.
Bye, Mary. See you in Atlanta.
See you guys. Right. Bye.
Bye, Mary.
Bye, David.
Now, David Vanderhoof has This Week in Aviation.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 32, October 10th through October 16th. October 10th, 1972, the United States Air Force begins a fly-off to find the AX aircraft. A head-to-head competition is against the Northrop YA-9A and the Fairchild Republic YA-10A. The AX competition continued until December 18th, 1972. The requirement specified for an aircraft with a maximum speed of 460 miles an hour, 740 kilometers an hour, a takeoff distance of 4,000 feet or 1,200 meters, and an external load of 16,000 pounds or 7,300 kilograms, a 285-mile mission radius, and a unit cost of $1.4 million. It's hard to believe you could buy a jet for $1.4 million.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Wait, what year was that?
1972.
Sorry. Okay, I'm going to inflation adjust. Give me a second.
Even with inflation, that's an amazingly low number.
We have $1.4 million?
$1.4 million.
That's the equivalent of 7.1 today. So still,
what kind of an airplane was that again, David?
An A-10.
Wow.
Now,
which brings me to my point that the winner was the A-10, which was announced in the following January. And for $1.4 million, this is really cool. Currently, the A-10C, the latest avionics updated A-10, is scheduled to be retired in 2028, 54 years after the initial win of the YA-10A.
Hmm. Wow.
So 54 years for $1.4 mil, it's not a bad deal.
That's a deal. That's a deal.
How much does a fighter jet cost like today?
200,
like 200 million.
Wow.
But then again, it depends, like with the F-35, it depends on how many of them you buy, because it's spreading those very, very high development costs across, X number of airplanes. What's X? Okay.
October 11th, 1919, and this one's for Dan.
Thank you.
Using Hanley Page 0400 World War I bombers, the Hanley Page Transport Service on its London-Brussels service begins serving the first in-flight meals. They were box lunches. The cost was 3 shillings. Adjusted for inflation, the meals would be $36.88 US or £23 sterling. Ryan Airways would be so proud.
This is what? Hanley Page?
0400. It was a World War I bomber that they decided to put seats in, and they were flying them for a couple of years from London to Paris.
Hmm. That's really cool. Well, it's funny because this past week, United had announced a new meal on their PS service between New York and LA and San Francisco. I think it cost, it cost $24.99, and people were like, wow, this is really expensive. But now I can say, well, compared to this.
See, I knew you'd appreciate that.
Yeah, see, thank you.
October 12th, 1924. Hugo Eckner begins the flight across the Atlantic Ocean from Frederickshafen to NAS Lakehurst. Eckner is delivering the LZ-126, and the flight was 81 hours at an average speed of 62 miles an hour for the 5,000-mile trip. The LZ-126 was finished and delivered to the U.S. Navy as reparations from the World War I as specified by the Versailles Treaties. The Zeppelin would be rechristened the ZR-3, otherwise known as the USS Los Angeles. The Los Angeles was decommissioned in 1932 and arguably would be the most successful military Zeppelin ever. On October 14, 1947, an orange rocket plane is raised into the belly of a B-29 mothership. Overhead, an XP-86A is piloted by George Welsh, makes a dive from 37,000 feet and causes a loud bang. That supersonic boom would be overshadowed 30 minutes later as Colonel Charles Chuck Yeager, with broken ribs, takes the Bell XS-1 through the unbreakable sound barrier. The XS-1, Glamorous Glennis, would become the aircraft that was the first aircraft to go supersonic. The aircraft would eventually lose the S in XS-1 to become the first of the X series of aircraft. And last but not least, October 16, 1955, a new age of intercontinental fighters ushered in as the Boeing 367-80, otherwise known as the -80, crosses the United States in 3 hours and 58 minutes. And that's the way it was. October 10th through October 16th, this is David signing off.
Oh, well done, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, October 10th, 2010.
Well, g'day, folks. Welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 118 of the Airplane Geek Show. I'm Steve Vischer. With me, as always, is Grant McHaren on this lovely Melbourne afternoon. G'day, mate.
Hey, mate. How you going?
Oh, wonderful. I've been out in the sunshine. I know I was cranky last week about the time change, but my goodness, what a lovely day. And I've been out looking at scale model aircraft today, so that should make David pretty jealous.
Finally realizing that you can use that extra hour to get some more sunshine and go out, huh?
Well, I know I use it to get some more sleep this morning before I got up.
Well, I'm a bit jealous because the weather has been great and I've been out helping to crew for the last 3 days in a row.
Grant, it's been a reasonably, I wouldn't say a huge news week this week for aviation down this side of the world, but there's a few stories here that we thought we'll just cover in brief and a couple of other ones that we might give a little bit of comment on. So the first one harks back to last week and it's just talking about the way Virgin Blue Chief John Borghetti dealt with the computer meltdown they had last week.
Yeah, that's right. They're back up and running. They switched back from the secondary backup system that they went to. They switched back to the primary. Unfortunately, that took a number of hours to do, but they knew it was coming, so they pre-cancelled a number of flights in advance to ensure that there weren't massive delays and flights slipping and so on. They just cancelled them and rescheduled all the passengers, called them in advance, that kind of thing. But they're now running on the back on the primary system. They've taken away the offending piece of hardware that died and replaced it with not-so-funky hardware, and we're just waiting to see what the end results are, because still to this day, no one has been able to explain why they didn't just cut straight over, why they kept trying to resolve the problem. I suspect that they actually were thinking they could solve it, fixed it, and then a new problem came up, and then the problem kept recurring, and it took them just too long before they threw in the towel and went over to the old one.
Yeah, well, apparently the company that runs that system called New Skies, which is Navitaire, and we had a bit of a chat about them last week, apparently they've been called in this week for some, shall we say, frank and open discussions with Virgin management. So wouldn't you have liked to have been a fly on the wall there, Grant?
Heck yeah, because Borghetti has said he is not happy at all.
And the next one we're going to deal with briefly here is talking about the Qantas chief executive, Alan Joyce. He's told a Trans-Tasman Business Circle lunch in Sydney recently that aviation was a key driver in the relationship between Australia and New Zealand and saw 931,000 Australians visit New Zealand in the new year. And he's urging a more common aviation agreement between the two countries.
That's right. We've reported on this a number of times. He's been very forthright and often saying that he wants the Trans-Tasman borders to be streamlined and, in fact, dropped. So there's no quarantine and customs. So going from Sydney to Auckland will be the same as going from Sydney to Melbourne, except slightly longer. He believes that will very much improve the flow of business across the Tasman. It's already a very, very busy Trans-Tasman route there with multiple airlines and lots and lots of flights, very busy part of the international airspace down here. But yeah, there's a lot of things to get through. New Zealand has some very, very tight quarantine issues, but there's also issues with various airports there. Some airports may lose duty-free. Because if you drop a lot of the restrictions, then going between Australia and New Zealand, there may not be any duty free anymore.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't be a good thing at all. I'm sure they could work their way around that one. We certainly wouldn't want to see that. Although, you know, I mean, you don't need visas to go to New Zealand these days, so the duty free issue would be one that they'd certainly want to keep going.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this one comes through. Whether he's actually able to help influence that occurring.
You know, so we're sticking with Qantas, Grant. Now they've had a bit of an incident this week on a flight to Hong Kong, where a man decided to get a little bit, possibly over-refreshed and decided he'd make a few death threats on the flight and threatened to blow the flight up, and, well, it didn't end up too well for him.
No, that's right. He went a bit kooky there, unable to confirm or deny rumours that he was praying beforehand, but apparently he made death threats to others and then threatened to kill himself as well. Mm. So what can you say? Another kook, and they've shown up on a Qantas plane.
Maybe he just received a letter about their new frequent flyer program, Grant.
That's very possible. They are introducing bag charges for their second bag, and they're also introducing a number of other fees. You're able to have up to 23 kilos in your first bag, and the second bag thereafter is $30. Now, note, this is for all frequent flyers, unless you're a premium, like top-end frequent flyer flying in business or first. But yeah, suddenly you can't take that second bag like you used to be able to. This isn't just for the unwashed masses. This is for the Qantas mainline, and this is for their frequent flyers. One of the other fees that they're bringing in is a $35 fee if you call their call center to transfer frequent flyer points to a member of your family from your account. So this is going to be interesting to see how their hordes of frequent flyers behave. They're introducing that new baggage checking system. It's doing reasonably well in Perth, and they're getting ready to roll it out in Sydney, where frequent flyers get special ID tags for their luggage and are able to go through and self-check-in and self-bag drop as well for their very frequent flyers. So it's going to be interesting to see how those folks react to these fees.
I'd say they won't react well to any fees. I mean, fees and charges for everything in this country are very big news at the moment, particularly now that there's talk of carbon tax being back on the agenda and all this sort of stuff. People are very sensitive to their to the cost of living at the moment. And for Qantas to bring this in, I think it's almost been a little bit disingenuous of them in a way, because as we've spoken before, Grant, that they've been quite proactive with their frequent flyer program. They've been hooking up with supermarkets, credit card companies, that sort of stuff. And as we said a few AusDesks ago, we actually thought that was a good idea, but now that they've got so many more people into these sorts of schemes that probably wouldn't have been in them before, and I'd count myself amongst that number, to be honest with you, now that they've got everybody in there, it's okay, now let's gouge them for everything we can get out of them. So it's almost telephone company mentality.
You know, we expect that with Jetstar and Tiger and people like that, but now they're doing it with Mainline, so it'll be interesting to see what happens. But you know, despite all that, people apparently are feeling a lot happier about Qantas's safety record. A couple of years ago, after their rather horrible time in 2008, when they had the 747 divert to Manila after the oxygen bottle exploded, they had the A330 do its porpoising roller coaster ride out of Learmonth in Western Australia. They had an ongoing dispute with engineers, and a number of other items are in the news all the time about any minor squawk, anything at all, that'd be in the news. And people's confidence in Qantas's safety dropped to 66%. Well, it's now gone back up to 83%. Everyone's like, no, they're safe again. I haven't heard any news about anything going wrong. So, yeah, I think they're safe.
Yeah, it is good to see. And I mean, Qantas has always traded very strongly on its safety record. And I know they would have been, or I would assume they would have been working very hard to restore that image. And, you know, as we've pointed out a lot in the past, a lot of these maintenance issues that they've had, okay, let's not talk about the major ones that they've had, but a lot of the comparatively minor day-to-day routine things, non-safety critical, have been finding their way into the media. Very easy for journalists to pick up and run with that sort of stuff when there's not much else to talk about. So it's good to see that people's faith is being restored in Qantas. They still do have a pretty good safety record, let's face it.
No, it's a very good one. They officially haven't lost a jet yet.
Well, folks, that's just about everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. Gee, we've packed a lot into that one, mate.
Yeah, it's been a pretty quick chat. I'm glad we were able to zip through a number of articles here.
Yeah, excellent. So I guess I'll get this ready to edit and head off to work. And Grant, I guess you'll be out into the sunshine again, or are you going to head off to bed seeing as you've got to get up at some ungodly hour and get up and go ballooning again?
Oh, a bit of both. I do have a couple of errands to run this afternoon, but yeah, I will be in bed quite early this evening so because it looks like we're going to get our fourth day in a row. And I can tell you, after 3 days of getting up early and chasing balloons, an extra couple of hours of snoozing is always a good thing.
Folks, episode 44 of Playing Crazy Down Under has just hit the virtual airwaves, so make sure you get out and download a copy of that. It's a very long one, but there's some great content in there, which we hope you'll enjoy. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, folks.
Well, I'm always glad when they're short, but that doesn't happen very often, does it?
None of us
just
are very
kidding,
short.
Guys.
I'll echo them on their episode 44, though. If you haven't heard episode 44 of Playing Crazy Down Under, I strongly recommend it. It's very long, but they've got some very, very good content. It's a real good listen, and not the least of which is our own David Vanderhoof, who puts in a really powerful military aviation segment. Good job on that, David.
It was the glass of scotch I was drinking beforehand, that's all. And really good editing by Vischer.
Yeah, it's a great episode. You got to listen to it. Okay, we got another Across the Pond from Peter Johnson.
This guy doesn't quit, does he?
No, he's getting very good at this, too.
But is he looking for a job or what?
I think he's found one.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Here he is.
And we just go, yeah, okay, go ahead.
Here's my view from Across the Pond. Welcome to episode 3 from Across the Pond. The oldest aeronautical race in the world, the Gordon Bennett Balloon Race, finished last week with the winners from Switzerland flying 1,513 miles from the start in Bristol, England, landing in Romania on the Black Sea coast. The Germans were second and the British third. Unfortunately, the race has been marred by the loss of two American balloon pilots who went missing last Wednesday, and race organisers say new radar information suggests they are unlikely to have survived. The American pilots, Richard Abruzzo and Carol Reimer Davis, disappeared over the Adriatic Sea when they reported bad weather conditions. Our thoughts go out to their family and friends. Now, a laser pen attack over Scotland. Yet another investigation has been launched in Scotland after a laser was shone into the cockpit of a commercial flight over West Scotland. The pilot reported the incident to ATC, who alerted the police. This incident follows the recent jailing of a farm labourer in Scotland who shone a laser into the cockpit of an RAF Tornado that was carrying out low-level flying training. There seem to be more and more of these incidents these days. Earlier this year, an Austrian flight departing Heathrow had a similar incident. Last year, there were 29 of these attacks alone at Heathrow. To combat this, a new law was introduced in January, making it a criminal offence to shine lasers at aircraft. Hopefully, there'll be more arrests and convictions as a near disaster is almost inevitable. Regional UK operator Flybe, which took over British Airways Connect business 3 years ago, plans to move into the market, looking to acquire at least one European carrier in the next 6 months. This will strengthen their position as the largest regional carrier in Europe. Chief Executive Jim French says, "We're looking at a range of acquisition opportunities in continental Europe, some of which we'd like to conclude by the end of this financial year. This should support their objectives on their growth strategy, making them a really strong operator. I regularly use them, as they have a good product, their fares are reasonable, and the aircraft new and clean, and they operate from regional airports close to large towns, which is really useful for business and personal travel. It'll be interesting to see who they go for." Flybe operates a two-type fleet, the Bombardier Dash 8 Q400 and the 118-seat Embraer 195s. This has taken them some time to consolidate down to, and any new acquisition would need to fit this profile for their economics to work. Now to some UAV near misses. Two official safety inquiries have just taken place after the UK's military use of UAVs caused near collisions with their own helicopters in southern England. These investigations are the first of their kind involving UAVs in the UK. A Lockheed Martin Desert Hawk 3 was being flown by the Army in military airspace over Salisbury Plain when it needed to land after running out of battery power at 500 feet. An Apache helicopter escorting a Chinook on a simulation exercise entered the landing zone and at one stage was on a collision course with the DH-3. The UAV controller saw the helicopter and prevented the collision. However, 3 hours later, a Sea King helicopter entered the same UAV's airspace and came within 900 feet of it. On both occasions, manned aircraft incorrectly entered the dedicated airspace allocated to it, said the Ministry of Defence. This suggests that it's human airborne pilots that may be to blame, as they had strayed into restricted airspace. I worry that both the helicopters and UAVs were operated by the Army, so what hope is there for civilian pilots? Since this incident, the area in Wiltshire, over which the military drones are allowed to fly, has been extended so that the Royal Artillery Corps could operate its new Watchkeeper UAVs. Worryingly, though, UAVs are being operated in civilian airspace as well by several services, such as police forces, government agency, and commercial operators, who are testing and using them. Most of these are micro UAVs, which are rotor-driven aircraft that hover at heights of about 180 feet and weigh around 44 pounds. Again, a civilian pilot, how are they supposed to see that? Before my final news item, I'd like to say that we're looking to develop this segment with some interviews with people from within the industry in the UK and Europe. Visit us at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com for more information. And finally, a nostalgic story for those on this side of the pond. Most of us who have flown with British Airways have at some time flown the Boeing 757. After 27 years, BA is repainting one of its Boeing 757-200s, Echo Tango, in the 83 livery to mark the type's retirement from the fleet later this month. It brings back memories of the last vestiges of British hospitality on those afternoon flights, which included tea, scones, cream and strawberries. Those were the days. Music for this episode is provided by White Harts, that's H-A-R-T. They're a band from Hertfordshire in England. You can see them at White Harts at MySpace or at Facebook. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Okay, all right. I think this is getting very dangerous because I can see where this is going. this is going to be like a podcast down under, but it's going to turn out to be a podcast over there.
Yeah. Well, if we keep this up, see, we won't have much to do ourselves.
I want to know where is Peter based? Do we know what city is he in? London?
I don't know.
Peter, you have to tell us where you're based. I really like that segment. I thought that was really, except for the. For the birdie. Did you hear his birdie in the background there?
No, that was Dan's bird.
Oh, that was Dan's?
That was mine, actually.
I thought that was this weekend. Oh, God. Poor. I'm sorry, Peter. Sorry, that's very unprofessional of me to accuse you of having a budgie. That's what they call our parakeets. They call them budgies.
Budgies? Wow.
Yes, yeah. Budgies. So, Dan, why do you have a bird?
I've had a bird since like, I've had this bird since I was like 10, so totally breaking the average lifespan of the budgie. So yeah,
that's an old 60s slogan. Actually, I never did quite understand exactly what it meant, but what, Max, you're probably old enough to remember that. They'd say, "How's your bird?" No,
okay. No.
Bird is the word. It said bird.
Oh, that's
bird
is right. The word. Yeah, I remember that.
Okay,
very good. Let's move on to some listener mail. First from Owen. Owen asks if we could possibly start a conversation and discuss what our favorite airports are and why. And I think we did that once a long time ago. It's probably... time to do that again. So I don't think we'll do that right now, but that might be something interesting. Or that could also be something interesting to ask our guests, those that travel a lot anyway. And our listeners, if you have a favorite airport and you'd like to tell us why, you can send us an email. Or
oops, sounds like a Facebook question.
There we go, David. There's this week's Facebook question.
Okay, I'm on it. I'm typing away.
Jeremy writes in, I like the podcast. I have an idea for a new shirt. A shirt with just airline tales of now and the past from all over the world. That would be interesting. Really, Courtney controls the t-shirt business. that part of the airplane geek. So we'll have to pass that on to him. I know there's a not too difficult way to introduce new T-shirt designs, but I don't know how to do it. So maybe Courtney can help us out with that. Let's see. We also got a nice email from Doug in Australia after listening to episode 117 and the listener mail from Stefan, who you may recall was the listener who has a little bit of a fear of flying. Doug writes that he and his wife are actually creating a self-help book designed to help with fear of flying. And he says it's very different from most books on that topic, and it's actually a lot of fun. But the book's not finished, and they're kind of testing a draft version, testing it on people who have a fear of flying to sort of get their reactions, get some feedback from them, and incorporate that into this book. So he sent a request for help. There's a website for this book, which is dragonsofthinair.com, and our listeners can download a preview of the book and take a look at it, particularly those who suffer from fear of flying or nervousness of flying, and provide your feedback and comments to Doug.
There's another section of it too, though. You know, there's going to be a fear of people who are afraid of flying section. in case you're put off by people that are afraid to fly. That might not be true. I may have just made that up.
Well, apparently there's a lot of people who have a fear of flying. Doug, you know, I'm not sure what Doug's source of information is, but he says that there are estimates that range from between 15% to 30% of the population. And that, you know, probably of those who do have a fear, maybe half of them just don't ever fly, and the other half do fly, but really hate it. Very, very uncomfortable by it. So it's it could really affect a lot of people. So if you're one of them, or if you know of one of them, send them over to that website, Dragons of Thin Air. Take a look at the work that Doug and his wife have been doing and see if it makes sense to you.
I think we need to have Doug and his wife on the podcast with us.
Maybe we could do that.
So long as we're doing that, do we need to invite this Peter guy? I mean, I feel obliged. I mean, the guy's...
Well, you know, what's interesting is all these people that we're talking about here are coming. They all have these accents, you know, Australian accents, British accents.
Yeah. Did you notice that? I had an accent. Don't you, David?
David has an accent.
I get accused of having one all the time if I start talking Joyzy.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Okay. Well, I think that's it for this episode, unless you guys have anything else. Anybody got anything going on that they want to talk about real quick?
Let's see. NBAA is coming up next week.
Right.
Let's see. I'm going down. I'll go down to the social media thing. Mary's going to be down there. So if anybody's going to NBAA, and then there's, of course, the big there's a big social media event coming up in San Jose, California on the 20th. I think it's the 25th, and it's going to have all the it's called the Social Media B2B High Tech Professional Conference. So in case you ever wondered where we learn about all the stuff that makes us so damn smart, it's because we listen to other really smart people, and we just sound like it came from us.
So that would imply that you're really smart, though.
Well, yeah, I noticed how I kind of zoomed right over that part.
I think Rob's smart.
Dan, he's smart enough to get put on jury duty, so that
that is true.
Or not smart enough to get off of it.
Yeah, well, actually, I have to say, because of course listeners don't know. I mean, I've been on jury duty all last week, and I'm going to be on jury duty all this next week. And it's actually a very interesting process. I mean, to watch how it all comes together. I mean, if you have any of the detective story lover in you, or a CSI fan, or any of that, you'd really like this. I mean, I find it terribly interesting, but that's just me, I guess.
Yeah, well, very good. And you're doing your civic duty.
That's right.
Okay, so I think that's it. Thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest this episode was Mary Kirby. You can find her at flightglobal.com/runwaygirl, and she also is on Twitter as Runway Girl. Be sure to see planecrazydownunder.com for more of Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren. really appreciate their segments. And like I said before, go listen to episode 44. It's long, but it's a really good one. Well worth it. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Dan, let's start with you. Dan Webb, where do people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage. You can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com.
Very good. And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, let's see. Jetwine.com is the blog. Jetwine is the Twitter ID. And next week it's NBAA, so come to the social media geek thing and cool. Hopefully we'll see you there.
Outstanding. And finally, David Vanderhoof, where do people find you?
You can find me at DM Vanderhoof or on Plain Crazy Down Under or on my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
Oh, very good.
Peter, how did he do?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, we'll hear that next week.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes and listener comments. Follow us on Twitter at airplanegeeks. If you want to send us email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we also have our fan page on Facebook.
Yeah, but what if people wanted to call in?
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet.
Damn, that was flawless.
Very
yeah,
good.
I don't understand how we get her to come on every week just at that time.
She loves us so much. She really does. All right, be sure to subscribe to the Airplane Geeks podcast on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace, if that's what you use. Also, we'd appreciate it if you leave us a comment or review, rather, on iTunes. Those really go a long way towards helping other people find the Airplane Geeks podcast. And as always, opening and closing music by the amazing Brother Love. Find his website, his music, at www.brotherloverocks.com. And the best thing you can do for us, if you will, is to be sure to tell your friends about the Airplane Geeks podcast. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
See you easy.
Thanks for listening. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks. You think I'd be able to do that by now, but I couldn't do it. Thank God we have you here.
Well,
could you do it from memory, David?
Welcome David. To the Airplane Geeks. This is David Vanderhoof on behalf of tonight's stories are, or I don't know, something.
All right,
no,
it's close.
I guess no.
Okay.
Sorry. All right, here, I'll give it a shot.
All right.
Welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast. This is episode. Hey, did those...
One more thing.
Yeah.
Dan, I want to congratulate you. Becoming the mayor of your college is one more step to your world domination.
Actually, you shouldn't be proud because I was mayor and lost it because I got lazy, so I had to take it back this week.
adding more to the theory that you're going to take over the world someday.
Oh, no. Rob doesn't know what
well,
this
is. The bad thing is, like,
I know what they're talking about.
Do you really?
Well, good heavens.
Oh, really?
How old do you think I am, Max?
Older than me.
Well okay.
we just got, because I got lazy because, like, for a while I was, like, the only person on my entire campus, no lie, who was using Foursquare. Well, there was maybe, like,
that's
one other person.
Yeah.
So... Yeah.
All right. Well, watch
but
that
actually,
stuff.
Rob, speaking of how old you are, I believe in a couple of weeks, our episode count divided by 2 will be your age. So there you go.
Leave it to the math wizards to work on that problem.
That's pretty good.
Thank you. Anna, in Chicago, we get paid $17. And 20 cents a day.
Oh, a day? I thought you were going to say an hour or something. A day. No. Wow.
Does that even cover your parking and food expenses?
They buy us lunch, so we don't have to worry about that. So parking costs me $8 when I get on the train. Of course, then the train is $5 up and back, so that's 13. So I'm $4.20 to the good for every day. I mean, this is a great thing.
This is more lucrative than podcasting.
I think, you know, it's a good point. Talk about an ROI.